The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 204 for Monday, Memorial Day, May 25th, 2009. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the show. I'm Dave Hamilton. I'm here with John Braun. How are you, John?
Good, good. Have a nice 4-day weekend.
That's good. Happy Memorial Day for to you and everyone else in the States that celebrates it.
Yep, the unofficial start of summer and all that.
Yep, absolutely. Now, you said, John, when we were doing the pre-show here, you said that there was another day being celebrated.
Well, it's not
today.
Only Memorial Day. Today is also Towel Day.
Now, explain to me what Towel Day is. I had not heard of this before you mentioned it to me, but I'm shocked because I'm a fan.
Yes, this is, and for you as your fans, you can already figure this out, but Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which is by Douglas Adams. One of the most important thing, if you were an intergalactic hitchhiker, is that you always know where your towel is. It's just one of the things in the book that proves to be true. And so people commemorate his, he's no longer with us, so they commemorate every May 25th, Towel Day, or at least a bunch of people do, or I saw tweets about it. So I hadn't heard of it either, but hey.
I wish I'd known. I would have brought a towel with me today. We trudged around Durham, New Hampshire, doing a family scavenger hunt, which was actually a lot of fun. But it would have been even more fun had we been able to carry a towel and explain why we had it to everyone. I think that would have been that would have been great. So last show we got deep into designing wireless networks and we had a bunch of cool stuff found on the list that we promised we would get to at the end of the show. And then, of course, you know, promises are cheap, yeah. Right? So we didn't actually get to them. So we're going to start the show with our promises here. And I'm going to turn around and pick up some of the goodness that I got here. I want to tell you about this thing. It's from a company called TrickleStar, TrickleStar.com.
Have one?
I'm holding it in my hand.
In front of you.
Wow,
in front of
you.
Video.
Well, see, I've been trying to do video, but, you know, the guy I do the show with says, I don't know if we can do video.
Oh, he could be a jackass sometimes.
Hey.
Keep going.
Oh, yo, you meant John.
That's
right.
That's Pilot Pete, ladies and gentlemen. So there are two things they sent me here, which are cool. The big deal here is the PC Trickle Saver. Now, they also have the regular TV Trickle Saver, they call it. And the idea here is any device that goes into standby mode draws power. Now, not a lot of power, that's the idea, but they do draw some power. And you have a lot of these devices, and it's going to draw, you know, grand sum total, a not insignificant amount of power. Their concept is, okay, look, you have one device that's the main device. Take your computer, right? You might have a printer and a scanner and perhaps a monitor, right, hooked up to your computer and all this other stuff. And really, none of it is useful to you unless your computer is not only on, but awake. And so the idea here is that you use the PC Trickle Saver, and it has three outlets on it, one or three extensions. One, you plug into power, into the wall. The other, you plug into the USB port of your computer. And lastly, you plug the final one, you plug a power strip into it, and you plug all the devices that you want to have controlled by your computer. As soon as your computer goes to sleep, this works with Macs, of course, and PCs. As soon as your computer goes to sleep, all this stuff goes off. Pretty cool. Now, they have another device called the PC Trickle Switch, which gets in the way of that USB signal, and you can press a little switch that even when your computer is on, it keeps all that other stuff off. Now, obviously, a monitor is not something you would want to have off when the computer is on, but a scanner or a printer might certainly be something that you do with that. So it's all available at TrickleStar.com. Now, it is a cool thing, and they make it for the TV as well. I will say, you want to engineer this system intelligently when you're setting it up. If you have your cable modem and your router, you probably don't want to set those to be controlled by this trickle saver, because you don't want those to turn off when your computer goes off, unless A, that's the only computer you're using it with, and B, you don't mind a little power up time from when you wake your computer until your internet access is actually up and alive. And the same with the TV. You know, they talk about using it with your television and your receiver and perhaps your TiVo and all that stuff. Obviously, if you've got a DVR, you don't want that to be off when your TV is off, because then it's not recording anything. And for me, I would not pull power from my AV receiver when my TV is off, because then it would lose all the settings that I have in there for, you know, what types of speakers I have and what volume I want my rear speakers and what volume I want my front speakers, etc. But used properly, this is a pretty cool device. So that's all available at TrickleStar.com. I wanted to throw it out there.
Don't throw it.
Cool stuff found.
How many clams does that?
So I could not find a price on the device that I have in my hand, and I think it's not quite out yet. I know the TV version is $30. My guess is this one falls somewhere in there, but because it's got USB, you know, that might add $10 to the price. Mm-hmm. But it's in that range.
Okay. And I saw something very similar. I went to a show a few weeks ago, ran into Mr. Hazelrig. And actually someone else on Twitter, maybe for the next show that they're having. Anyways, I think it's a bowling theme. I think we're actually going to get to do bowling. That could be fun.
What was the show?
Echo Focus is the show. But anyways, okay. Monster, you know, the ones that sue everybody.
the cable company?
Yeah.
Monster Cables.
Apparently they make power products. And they have one called the Monster Green Power Digital Power Server, Power Center MDP900. At least that's one of the products.
Okay.
And it does something very similar. You plug things into certain, receptacles on this device. And then when you shut the computer down, it shuts down. Similar to what you described, it'll shut down all the other things.
Yep.
So this
monster thing has the power strip built into it.
Yes.
It's not just the control device. It's the control device with a power strip. And I seem to remember that one being not cheap, right? $130.
I don't think it really has control. I think it's all built into the device.
Okay.
But I do see on here, I mean, it looks like they have cable connectors, several different type of connectors that filter out surges and stuff like that.
Okay.
Yeah, the retail price is $149. So,
okay.
You know, like Monster stuff is priced, I guess.
The TrickleStar device, it does not do surge protection, to my knowledge, but it does prevent. I asked them, I said, look, you know, I'm plugging something. I'm wary of plugging a device into the wall and then plugging it into my USB port. You know, this sounds dangerous, right? And they said, no, not to worry. You are shielded. The USB circuit is completely separate from the power circuit, and surges, you know, in theory should not cross the great divide there. So, all right. Brent, Mr. Truck Lover on Twitter and our fill-in AAC conversion guy, sent in this comment.
Hey guys, it's Truck Lover Brent from the Gulf Coast of Mississippi. I just finished listening to the latest podcast, and I just wanted to say you guys are just a hoot to listen to. It's funny. I always enjoy listening to it, and definitely brings a laugh. I want to follow up on three things from this Monday's podcast and previous shows. So on Cool Stuff Found, one thing that I've really liked is a little application called Soundfly or Soundfly Receiver. What it is two applications, and it installs on two different Macs. So I have a laptop and I have a desktop. And what I'm able to do is basically any sound that comes out of, say, the laptop, you know, if I'm sitting on the couch and my desktop is hooked up to the stereo speakers, I can get the sound output to go from the laptop over the wireless network or wired network to the output of the desktop and vice versa. So if I'm playing any sound on another machine, I can say I don't want it to come out of the sound on this speakers. I want it to come out of the sound, the speaker output of the other machine. So one computer runs Soundfly and one computer runs Soundfly Receiver. Great little application to basically route your audio over the network of your house. It's cool stuff. Also, a Dropbox, something else that y'all talked about recently. I've been using Dropbox for over 6 months. As a college student, I keep all of my documents on there. I do not even use the user's documents folder on my computer. And that's fantastic for me because, as you said, I can share folders with other college students that are working on a project. Everybody has that same file. I update it. They all have a copy. They update it. You know, everybody else's files stays in sync. Also, the beauty of it is that I can go back whenever I started using Dropbox, which was 6+ months ago, I can get any file that I want back however it was 6 months ago. So if I deleted something 5 months ago, I can go back and get it. That's fantastic. And I also recommend Dropbox for people that do not have any other source of backup for their documents. I have talked to several college students where they lost all their files. They lost everything because of a hard drive crash or viruses on their ill-fated Windows machine. So as a backup solution, it's fantastic. And if you don't have any more than 2 gigs, it's the best thing to do, because as soon as you put a file in Dropbox, like you know, it gets up to the cloud. So if anything happens to that file, you lose it, you delete it, and you didn't really need it back, just log into the web interface, and there you go. It's awesome. That is a lifesaver for several college students who just can't afford external hard drives or online backup and what have you. The last thing that I wanted to follow up on is GarageBand. A couple of shows ago, somebody was digitizing their vinyl record, their analog audio sources. And I have done this numerous times as I have digitized my records, and I've used GarageBand to do so. And it will, in fact, export those files as individual tracks. I record a single worship service for that gets dedicated to 2 separate podcasts. One is for the sermon, one is for the worship and the, you know, the media, the singing and all that. Some people may want to subscribe to only one, some may subscribe to the other or even both. So, yes, you can, in GarageBand, record the entire vinyl record start to finish, you know, side one, 15 minutes, pause it, flip your record, and then do side two. And then what I do is I actually create 2 different tracks, you know, track one, track two, and I just keep adding the plus button, and I, you know, here's song one, and then song two goes to the next track, and I can export those out individually to iTunes and what have you. So those are the 3 things that I wanted to follow up on. I'm going to end this conversation. I'll talk to you guys later. Enjoy.
Hey, all right. Thanks, Brent. Amen. That's, you know, we can learn something from him, John. He was very concise. He packed 3 things into the time it'll take us to talk about the next one here. So,
well, you know, I want to mention one thing where actually it saved the day for me. So, I was working at home on Thursday. I had my, my PC. Unfortunately, I didn't have my power supply. So I had 2 batteries, but I wasn't getting much use. So, you know, I was just at the point in the day where someone from Microsoft is going to call me back because I'm working on a support issue with them. And one battery I sucked up, and the other one, I thought the machine was in standby mode, but something prevented it from going to sleep. So it ran its battery down to, like, you know, minutes.
Okay.
And then the guy after that, so my PC basically, like, died in front of me as I'm on the phone with the guy. I'm like, oh, great. And I didn't have my power supply. Fortunately, a coworker actually brought it by on his way home. But so what got me, though, is he's like, well, can you send me the file that you, you know, your installer, it's an installer and some other things. And I'm like, oh man, you know, my PC's down. And then I realized what I had been using is to test this installer. I'd been using Dropbox between my PC and a virtual machine running under VirtualBox. I was using it as the, because even a USB drive is a pain in the neck. Because a lot of times these VMs, only one person can own the flash drive. So it gets to be kind of, you know, tedious.
Right.
Or a shared folder or stuff like that. It's just Dropbox is kind of the easiest way to do this, assuming you have a zippy network and you're not, you know, shuttling around, you know, massive amounts of data, which in this case, it wasn't a lot of data, a few hundred K. So it was really the best way to do it. But then what was cool is that I had deleted it. But as we talked before, I was able to do a restore and take the most recent version and send it to the guy. Otherwise, assuming I didn't get my, you know, power supply for my friend, I would have had to wait until the next day I came into work.
That's awesome.
So the restore feature, and I'm curious how long that lasts. Or
people have written in and said that they've pulled stuff from 6 months ago, 8 months ago. So I think it lives for a while. I'm not sure what they guarantee.
Yeah. Because a lot of version control systems will, you know, actually save that stuff unless you explicitly say destroy it. So I assume at some point they'll purge, you know, the oldest stuff, similar to Time Machine, which we're going to talk about a little more later. But what's next?
Actually, let's talk about Time Machine right now. So Margaret wrote in and said, as a website designer, keeping my files backed up is important. I switched from the Kluge Retrospect to Time Machine last year. I absolutely love the ease of making backups and restoring files, but two things have made me nervous about relying on it. First, I had the same data corruption issues that John had last year, screwed up sparse bundles. Second, I never know what Time Machine is doing. I seem to have solved the first problem by giving up on a NAS drive and using Drive Genius, and I stumbled across a possible solution to the second, a widget called Time Machine Buddy. It displays the current and past status of Time Machine and displays the corresponding messages, details about the backup, which appear to be backup D reports from the system log. You can also scroll back through past backups to see older messages. By having this on my dashboard, I'm much more likely to notice a problem with Time Machine, and I immediately have the details about what went wrong. Yeah, so what Margaret has found is an app. It doesn't have any data you can't get elsewhere, but it does kind of pull all this data into one window, one UI, and that way she sees everything all at once. And like she said, she's more apt to look as opposed to opening up the console, filtering for backup D. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that's what this app is doing. It's just doing a search on the system log, pulling back all the stuff that talks about backup D and reporting it to her. But here it's automatic. It pulls it. And so thanks, Margaret. That's fantastic.
And you probably want to use Time Machine Editor also, because Time Machine tends to be a real chatty Cathy.
Mm-hmm.
And so all that log info, you may get kind of sick of it.
Yeah, so what John talked about and glossed over quickly there is something we've mentioned before, a Time Machine Editor. It allows you to set the backup interval for when Time Machine backs up. So you're not forced to back up every hour. You can back up once a day if you want. You can back up every 3 hours, whatever you want. So, highly recommended. Now that I have that, I couldn't live without it. And we're going to talk a little bit more about Time Machine later. But we do have at least two more cool things found, and perhaps more along the way. Catching my breath. Allergies today for me have been horrendous, and I never have allergy problems. But here I am today, eyes itching and throat scratchy. And Sharon says, I cannot take credit for this one. My current job lets me listen to hours and hours and hours of podcasts to help me get through the day. And credit for this goes to Al at the Mac Roundtable podcast, who found this. It's called Etherpad at etherpad.com, Etherpad.com. It's a free collaborative writing web-based tool. I think the other podcast was using this for doing their show notes, as each person can contribute to the whole document. You can invite as many people as you like simply by giving them the directly URL provided when you create a pad. You can save revisions of your work and have unlimited undos. This is, I checked this out. There's a video. That's a combination of a movie and a video. A movie that you can watch. Thanks. Where you can see this in action. You can see what it looks like when four people are editing a document. And it's awesome. Very cool for that collaborative editing. You can be editing one section of the document and actually see other people editing the other section of it live right there in your web browser. So it's like, you know, Google Docs on roids or Rails or whatever you want to call them. Mm-hmm. Is it time for me to talk about Air Radar? I love Air Radar. So I stumbled onto this. John, you had done a Monday's Mac gadget back in September on this, as you told me during our pre-show. Mm-hmm. I missed that, or I saw it, but never paid attention to it. I don't know why. Maybe because you've never mentioned it on the show. Could I say that, perhaps? But Air Radar is a perfect, to me, app for discovering the details of and just the existence of other wireless networks. Much better, in my opinion, than iStumbler. For one, it will show you the channels of 5 gigahertz network, which is something iStumbler will not do. And for another, you can click on a network and get details, and it'll show you security settings and all sorts of stuff about the network in a really clean interface. So it's called Air Radar. It is $10, but right now, and I don't know how long this is going to last, MacUpdate.com. If you go to MacUpdate.com/somethingbig.php, of course, we'll put that in the show notes. It will allow you to, you can get it for free. You got all you got to do is sign up at MacUpdate and boom, you can download it and register it for free. So I like it. You have anything to say about it, John?
Anything
to add?
Already been said.
All right. You know, while we're so I think we're done with Cool Stuff Found. We have a bunch of comments about our airport discussion last week, so I want to get into those here and make sure we address that topic. But first, our sponsor for this show is Audio Engine at audioengineusa.com. They have the Audio Engine W2, which is a wireless speaker adapter for your iPod or iPhone. It plugs into the dock connector on the bottom of your iPod or iPhone, and any audio that you would send out of your phone or iPod gets blasted across this wireless signal to a receiver, and you connect the receiver either up to just a set of speakers or to your stereo receiver in your house. And it, you know, think of it as a dockless dock for sound. You can carry your iPod or iPhone around as the remote. And when you choose a new song to play, boom, it starts coming out of your speakers wherever they are. It uses the same wireless technology that the other Audio Engine products, the W1, uses. So it is, you could watch a movie on your iPod or iPhone and have the sound coming out of speakers elsewhere. It will stay in sync, and it's full high quality sound. It's not, I've used it here and it's not degraded in any way. It's full quality sound. It's $169 from Audio Engine USA, and it is the Audio Engine W2. Again, it's a little dock that hangs off the bottom of your iPod or iPhone and sends the signal wirelessly out. You got anything else on that one, John, while I wet my whistle here?
Nothing. I could hum a little tune.
Oh, well, I'm always up for being entertained. You could hum a little tune and people could do a little dance. So the dance isn't, if you won't let us do video, the dance isn't really worth the entertainment value. So, but talking about doing a little dance is sort of funny. All right. We will go to Cyrus here. And this is a question we actually wanted to play in.
Oh, wireless. Oh, I got something I'll mention later. Or I can mention it now.
Go. We're shifting our discussion to picking up from the airport discussion last week. And I have no idea where John's going to go with this. So that's
great. The one thing that got me, though, so we were talking about placement, and you made a very valid point. But it was still nagging me in the back of my mind. And let me just, So I think it's a question to the user. So you said, and your statement was entirely correct, that with an omnidirectional antenna, the radiation pattern is pretty much circular.
Spherical,
yes. It's that it's going out in all directions, you know, unless there's stuff in the way, metal or liquids, or in general. The thing that gets me is I was looking, because I've worked with different type of antennas, and there's, you know, circular, there's, you know, horizontal polarization, vertical. There are ways that antennas can influence, you know, which way. And what I was trying to find, and I know people do this sort of thing. We actually have a lab that does it, but everything has a radiation pattern. And sometimes they can be unexpected, depending on what type of. And I got to look for a take apart of an airport and just see what they're doing, because, I mean, I'm sure you know, to me, the most sense would be, yes, an omnidirectional antenna. But I read reports like of some very, very early Apple units, like, you know, the old spaceship ones where I guess they were not quite, omni. They were somewhat directional, either due to the weird way the antenna was or something like that.
Oh,
but,
really?
But I'm wondering if anybody's, I looked and I didn't find anything. I mean, the search, I tried to Google for radiation pattern and airport express or airport extreme and didn't really find a lot.
Huh.
I mean, one could also do it if you have, you know, like you use, for example, well, we kind of suggested it, but if you use something like air radar and you boogie around, you'll get signal strength readings and can kind of draw a very rough, you know, 3D diagram. It's a pain in the neck. It'd be much nicer to have, you know, a machine that does this, which basically, you know, just rotates an antenna around something and then it builds a 3D graph and you're like, oh, okay, that's
right.
So if anybody's done that or anybody knows where to find that info, I'd be very, very interested, or just knows, you know, what type of antenna we got in some of the latest Apple stuff.
Yeah, I know when, you know, I'm brought back to my audio experience where when you buy a microphone, you can, you know, they always publish a pickup pattern, right? You know, and it might be omnidirectional or cardioid or hypercardioid. Right. But even with those very general descriptions, it's never exact. And so they you know, release this picture. It's a drawing of, okay, when you're in front of the microphone, here's what you're going to get. And as you get around the side, it's not going to be as good, or it's going to be better, or whatever. So, yeah.
And I've even seen kits. They'll get kind of squirrely with the latest AirPort, but there are external antenna kits. Now, with the older ones, which actually had a PCMCIA card with an antenna connector, and I actually still have one sitting around somewhere, where if you get an external antenna and you know what you're doing, you can almost always improve the performance versus, you know, what's buried in there.
Yeah, I have one of the old Snow AirPort Extreme base stations, so 54G, and I use an Extend Air. Gosh, I'm trying to remember what it's called. I don't think it's the Extend Air Omni. It's a different Extend Air. Gosh, I can't remember the name of it. Extend Air Direct is what they call it. And that does allow me to kind of blast the signal. What I do is I plug it into the AirPort Extreme, and it lets you focus the signal in one direction. So I put it in one corner of my house and broadcast it away from that corner, because I just don't need it going the other direction. And it does help, because clear in the other corner of the house is the TiVo and the Wii. So these are important devices to reach. And it does. It seems to help. So, I don't know, you know, maybe it's just in my head.
It could be.
Yep. Cool. All right. So that was a nice little blend of cool stuff found into our AirPort discussion here. And we'll let Cyrus take it away.
Hey, John and Dave. This is Cyrus in Round Rock, Texas. Got a question about Mackie Gab 202, where you talk about router interference. Actually, wireless router interference. Is there a way, or is there a wireless router that automatically selects a channel that has the least amount of interference from other wireless routers, so that you don't have to go in and experiment with different channels? Or if you are not technically inclined and even know how to do it, you're not forced to get into the internals of the setup for the wireless router. I love your show, and I'd love to hear what kind of feedback you've got. Thanks.
Okay, so John, I think most routers now actually do have an automatic mode. Apple's routers certainly do with the current firmware. Even the older routers do this with the current firmware. And it can be handy, because the router does a scan, figures out what channel is the least used, and goes ahead and chooses it. Now, the problem is, and the reason that I wouldn't necessarily recommend using this, is in my experience, and again, please correct us if I've got this wrong, but in my experience, it does not constantly or regularly do this. It only does it on startup. So if your router is going to be up for, you know, months at a time, don't expect that it's going to adapt. And if it sees another network on that same channel, I don't think it's going to move. I'm pretty sure it doesn't, but maybe not. So
I was looking, and I could not find any data to indicate that it did it on a constant basis. I was trying to look for something, even in some of the 802 specs, to say, you know, if you're set for auto, does it try? And I guess it's up to the vendor. And I guess some vendors, I think you mentioned this, don't even offer the option. So have to choose something manually.
So that's one reason why I would choose something manually, John. The other reason that I would choose it manually is, it only scans the area that it can see, right? And typically, if you're close to the router, it's going to be okay, even if you've got something else on that channel. It's not necessarily going to be great, but you're not going to start running into problems. Where you run into problems is if you're at the edge of the router's range, like I mentioned before, with my TiVo clear on the other corner of the house, the router's not going to see the same things in its corner that the TiVo's going to see in its corner. And so the router's not going to know that, there's is something else that's reaching as far or to the edge of where I can reach that has that same frequency. It's just not going to pick it up. And that can cause problems. And in fact, for me, it did cause problems. And I then had to go change that channel, and now I'm fine. It's not bad to use it. It's certainly nice to have it auto sense that on startup. And, you know, if you're having a problem and you think, well, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to turn off my router and restart it. Well, maybe it's going to fix it, you know, because it will sense that on startup. But but you're better off taking a computer and going around using something like Air Radar, which we mentioned, and going to the edges of the range and figuring out what else you see there, because it is going to be different at the edge. If there is stuff at the edge, you won't necessarily see it when you're in the center. Right, John?
Right.
You got anything to add there?
I don't know if it's appropriate for this question. Well,
all right, then. Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Interference robustness. I don't know.
That's actually good to talk about with Andrew's question. Should I play?
That's what
Andrew's
I was thinking.
Question?
You could go for this one. And
all right, I'll play. You know what? Let me throw Mike's thing in here just to get it, and then perfect. All right. So Mike says, after listening to this week's show, I thought about my WPA security setting and how I was set to WPA PS key, pre-shared key, TKIP. And off the top of my head, I do not remember what TKIP is, but I know already John is looking up TKIP and AES. I switched it to WPA PSK, TKIP and AES. And now my wife's PC shows up fine, but still no G4. I see Alex. Let's see. I'm going to back up here because there is he sent us two emails and he forwarded the first one in. So what was happening was his G4 was not seeing his G4 and his PC were having trouble seeing all the other computers on the network. He could connect them. He could get on the internet fine, but he could not see the rest of the stuff. He went through these security settings. And now his PC showed up fine, but his G4 would not show up to be shared amongst his other computers on his network, nor would it show up on that computer. He couldn't see any of the others. What he wound up realizing was that his G4 and presumably his PC before that were connected to his neighbor's wireless network, similar to the problem I talked about with the client and her printer recently. And that's why they couldn't see anything. So the moral of Mike's story here, which I hope I made clear, is make sure that your computers are connecting to your wireless network and not your neighbor's or someone else's. Because if they are, you'll get on the internet fine. And if that's your goal, well, hey, more power to you. But if you want to share files amongst them or share printers or any resources, you want to make sure you're connected to your network. And on the Mac, you can go in, of course, into System Preferences, Network, and John and Pete are, John and Pete have a Skype thing going. System Preferences, Network, Airport, and you can click Advanced and remove the airport networks to which you do not want to connect. And then that way, your Mac won't automatically connect to your neighbors and that sort of thing. So TKIP stands for Temporal Key Integrity Protocol. And John, AES stands for?
Oh, I think that's Advanced Encryption Standard.
And in my experience, the Mac is much happier using AES. Do not set it to both. I think you're better off setting it to WPA2 for your encryption and AES as the key management or whatever it is. That's what I have to say.
That's all you got to say?
Yeah, that's it. Right. But Andrew's got something to say.
Hi, John Dave. This is Andrew. Listening to your last podcast about Wi-Fi networks, and I wanted to add a few things you missed. The first thing about things in your house that can cause interference, you left out two big ones. The first one is the microwave. And while a microwave is not running, it's not too much of a problem except it's a square of metal. But if it is running, it's creating very, very high energy, 2.4 gigahertz radiation, which definitely interferes with G and B Wi-Fi and if it's running on that channel too. So if you're setting up a situation, you don't want to have a microwave be in between the base station and where you're going to be using your computer a lot. isn't necessarily a problem, but your internet can duck out when the microwave turns on for that reason. The similar one is if you have wireless phones, so landlines that have a wireless connection. These function either in a 2.4 gigahertz range, just like Wi-Fi, or in a 5 or sometimes 5.8 gigahertz range. And so that's another thing to consider if you have, and if you use wireless phones, it's good to have them be in the channel that you're not using for wireless internet, and that way they don't interfere with each other. Similar to Wi-Fi, cordless phones do have channels, but they, unlike Wi-Fi, they traditionally sort of just pick whichever one they like. And so instead of finding a channel and sticking on it, they will frequently bounce around between different channels and get in your way. So it's not necessarily easy to have Wi-Fi and cordless phones play nicely with each other on the same channel. The other thing that I wanted to warn your listeners about is about bridge mode, because not all routers support bridge mode. And I had a situation with this where my uncle got a new Netgear router that was a basic cheap router because he wanted to extend the range of Wi-Fi in his house. And he was a little misguided to start with because it was an N router, which, you know, was advertising greater range. And so he brought it home and didn't realize that none of his computers had an N Wi-Fi card in it, so it didn't actually expand his range practically, having it where it was. But we tried to set it up in bridge mode halfway across the house so that it would extend the network, and that the Netgear router did not support going into bridge mode, and that you had to plug a Ethernet port into the back of it to get it to do anything. And even once you did that, it wouldn't repeat, and it also wouldn't become a slave. The software was stripped so that it would only, you know,
And that's actually where the voicemail cut him off. But he did mention a couple of good things in there. So thank you, Andrew. So right, the 2.4 gigahertz interference from the microwave is key. Now, John, earlier you mentioned something about a setting called interference robustness.
I did? Yes, I did. So anyways, that is in when you go to radio mode and you're in one of the 2.4 gigahertz radio modes, if you click on wireless options in the airport utility, you'll see a little checkbox, use interference robustness, which it says, you know, it helps with things like cordless phones or wireless video monitors. Okay. They should say microwaves, too, because I think that was one of the big, you know, because that operates at 2.4 gigahertz. And I think it changes some of the timing or framing or whatever, so they're less likely to interfere with one another. I think you may take a little performance hit, but, you know, at least it'll work.
Yeah. It definitely does take a performance hit. The other thing we should talk about, a couple of settings that get a little wacky in there. You'll see on the airport, in the airport utility, you'll see settings that talks about multicast rate. And you can set that. By default, it's at 2 megabits. And on mine, of course, I think it goes from 1 to 11. What that is, multicast is the protocol by which, and John, please help me here because I might get this description wrong. It allows you to, from one computer, send out one stream, so perhaps a video stream, that can then be received by multiple computers on your network. And then there's multicast on a LAN, which is what I'm talking about on a local network. And then you can do wide area multicast as well. But it allows you to send one signal out. Instead of, you know, if I want to have the video that I'm sending appear on your laptop and on Pete's laptop and on my wife's laptop, I could send it individually to all three, but now I'm using triple the bandwidth, or I can use multicast to send it out to all of you with one stream. That multicast rate is, you set it to what you want the minimum rate to be of a connection. Now, before it allows multicast. With airport, the further you get from the base station or the more interference or the lower your signal is for whatever reason, your rate, you know, you might start it at what they call 54 megabits, which isn't really, but, and then it ratchets down and you might go to 11 or 7 or 5.5 or 3 or 2 or 1. And by default, multicast on the airport routers is set to 2, which means that if your signal is such that your rate is less than 2, it will not address multicast packets to you. This is up to the router to decide, and it will not send them to you. You can set that lower and allow more multicast packets to be sent. So that's what that is. Most of us will probably never use it, but I know just by saying that, somebody's going to write in and say, actually, that's not true. Such and such service uses it, and please do, so that we can get that right.
Yeah, I'd like to hear anybody use it. I don't think I've ever knowingly used it. My understanding is that it's a specific type of IP address, and if the router recognizes this IP address as being multicast, then it redistributes or rebroadcasts in a smarter way than clogging the network. Though again, I don't know if I've knowingly or unknowingly used something like that.
Yep.
So, but that's a good one to point out because I guess you got to think of what people are doing with the network and whether you want to restrict them so they don't hog all the bandwidth.
Right. That's right. Yeah. Okay. So I had, I don't know, we had several people write in and say, what about SSIDs? SSIDs being the name of the wireless network. When you're using multiple base stations to extend a network, you know, we talked about bridge mode. We're not going to go through that again. You got, you know, show number 203 hopefully explains that well enough. We didn't get a whole lot of questions about it, so I think we got it. But when you've got all these base stations set up, what is the best thing to do? Do I set a different name for the network of each base station, or do I use the same name across all of them? And the general consensus out there is that you're better off using the same name and the same encryption settings or the same security settings across all of your base stations so that your clients can just move from one to the other and basically seamlessly to the user hop from one access point to the other without realizing it, without having to re-authenticate and go through all that. There are a couple of gotchas here. When organizing your network, you want to make sure that you are using different channels. So same name for the network, but different channels so that they're not interfering with each other. If you're on 802.11g, you want to use 1, 6, and 11. Each of those is discrete from the other. So if you've got, you know, if you've got 3 access points or less than 3, it makes it easy. Use 1, 6, and 11. As long as your neighbors don't have any of those, you're good. If you've got 5, what you want to do is lay it out so that there are no there are no 1s next to each other. There are no 6s next to each other, no 11s next to each other. The other thing I will point out, and this is something I tested this weekend here. I set all my G base stations to be the same, whereas previously I had not had them that way. And I set all my 5 gigahertz base station to be the same. And what I found was that is not good because the Mac anyway, based on my testing this weekend, will pick the base station with the strongest signal. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean the fastest signal. If I had an N and a G available to me and I was in the house today, the G base station, this with my MacBook Pro, so it can do full, you know, 230 megabit N connection. My MacBook Pro had a 56 signal strength to the G and a 39 or something to the N, and it picked the G base station, and I could not force it to pick the N. I mean, there's just no way. They both had the same name. So I highly recommend using one naming structure for your 2.4 gigahertz and then one name for your 5 gigahertz and spread your network out that way. And then that way, you know, you say, oh, I'm a 5 gigahertz client. I'm going to choose that one and then migrate around. So that's my advice based on what I read online and obviously what I tested here.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. And actually, if you go to any, you know, trade show, airport.
Right.
You know, place that offers Wi-Fi and you fire up something like Air Radar, you'll see this. You'll see they have different MAC addresses, but the same name and different channels for the most part.
Right. Right. Very cool. All right. Before we get into the kind of miscellaneous questions for this week, John, in our pre-show tonight, we had a little bit of chatter about Time Machine, and enough so that it seemed worthwhile creating a topic impromptu for it. So
it would seem that way.
You want to start this one, John?
Well, I saw something. I thought this was, you know, due to the nightmare that I had with you know, 10.5.7 here. One thing I noticed when I rebooted it and, you know, after I installed the update was, oh man, Time Machine's just sitting there doing nothing again. I'm like, oh no, because as most of you know, I and others have had issues with corrupted images on the Time Machine Time Capsule.
I have one, in fact, on the machine that we're podcasting on today. It decided to tell me that it was corrupted, so I've got to use Drive Genius and see if I can't make her go.
Okay, or even Disk Utility, you know, long time.
Okay, all right. Well,
but anyway,
try.
So what I did is, you pointed, you know, earlier, if you use console and you look for backup D messages, and this was the message I saw, which I had never really looked for before. Don't recall seeing, but it said backup D, which is the name of the Time Machine process. Node requires deep transversal slash blah, 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 and the name of the volume, and then reason, and buried in that is, let's see, flag reason event DB untrustable. So I think what it's saying, I got to re-index or just figure out, you know, this whole directory here that you pointed me at, because something changed from the last time I've seen it. I think that's what it's saying. But anyways, okay. It sits there for a good long time until it gets past that point. Sometimes it could be an hour or something like that, but it will, in my experience, always get past that point, and then everything is happy.
Yep. I've seen that too. I think...
So don't freak out. If you see that message, it's doing some work. It may take a while.
I think it happens if it sees something that it doesn't expect to see, which often is caused when a backup is stopped midstream, either by a machine going to sleep or falling off the network, or, you know, one of those various things that can happen. And it just sort of wants to make sure, okay, integrity check time, forget what I think I know. Let me look and get new data and get myself in sync with what's out there. So I saw something interesting. I sent it to you earlier this week. I was looking at, and I can't pull it up now, of course. There it is. I was looking at my backup logs, and my time capsule, I have a 1 terabyte time capsule, and I back up 5 max to it, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I think, and it's getting full, right? Now, Time Machine is supposed to manage this, and one of the things that I saw out there was it said compacting storage in the logs. I requested 1.42 gigabytes, 1.40 was available. Stopped the backup, canceled the backup, ejected the Time Machine disk image, and then the line says compacting backup disk image to recover free space. It did that for, I don't know, a minute or two. Then it started the backup again, and instead of having 1.40 gigabytes, it had 5.46 available. So it's clearly there's something going on with the way the sparse bundle is managed, that deleted files aren't always totally cleared out. And it goes in and sort of wipes those old backups out when I think it had deleted them long before this, but now it actually went through and freed up the space that had been marked as deleted by these. But I do have to say something. You know, Apple markets this time capsule as a device that you can back up multiple machines to. I've got the 5 backing up to it. The drive sits at full all the time. And I, this weekend, had a machine that where it said, look, I need, you know, it started and it said there's like 4 gigs available and I need 5. And then as days went on, it said there's, you know, 4 gigs available or 3. I need 7. I need 11. I need 18. And it's like, you know, aren't you supposed to manage yourself? And the problem is each computer manages. This is where this sort of thing breaks down. That the benefit of Time Capsule is its Achilles heel, right? Where there's nothing managing all of the backups on the drive and nothing seeing it from a holistic approach. Each computer sees its own stuff and could care less about what else is on the drive and what else is happening. Whereas, you know, if you were using something like Retrospect, where it's seeing everything, you can say, oh, wait, I need some disk space. I've marked my computers to say, look, it's fine if you need to delete old stuff, but my computers will only delete their own old stuff. So I've got one machine that's got backups going, you know, all the way back to July, and another machine that can't get a backup in because there's no room on the drive. It's like, well, wait a minute, go, you know, steal from Peter if you need to and pay Paul. But it won't do that because it's not smart enough. It could. The permissions are such that it could traverse through those and say, oh, yeah, wipe this stuff out. We're good. And hopefully Apple is working on this because I think, you know, certainly we've had people out there who have had time capsules for more than a year. They came out last February. And I know I'm not the only one going through this. But, you know, I can't make it delete old stuff from one to free up space for the other. It's I don't know. It's not good. It's a failure. It's one of these times where Apple has not had enough vision on a product. So we'll have to see how it goes. You have anything to solve my problems there, John? You gonna make my life better?
Buy two of them.
Yeah, that's the answer. Like, well, to heck with that. I don't need backups from July on that machine. You know, go ahead and ask me. I'll tell you no. All right, where are we time-wise here? We have time to talk about. Wow, it's 50 minutes already. Look at us go. All right, we got to answer some questions here. All right, so Andrew, and I don't think it's the same Andrew, but it might be. Andrew says, and we have a comment from Brian on this one too. Andrew says, a caller asked about booting his Intel Mac with SuperDuper. Dave discussed using GUID partitioning scheme to make a USB drive bootable with Intel-based Macs. Out of curiosity, I cloned my Intel-based MacBook Pro or Mac Pro to my Western Digital Passport drive as usual upon using the latest version of SuperDuper. I checked in Disk Utility and the partitioning scheme for the Passport was set to Master Boot Record. However, since SuperDuper's last function to make drive bootable, I thought I would test the Passport to see if it would boot my Intel-based MacBook with an Intel Core Duo. Sure enough, holding down the option key showed my USB Passport drive as bootable selection. I booted right into it. My MacBook Finder and dock looked exactly like my Mac Pro, and I could access all my data. And as it turns out, Andrew, you are correct. In fact, there's more data, as Brian will share with us here, where he says EFI, which is the extensible firmware. John, you're going to look that up if you don't know it already. Recognizes both APM, Apple Partition Map, and GUID drives. And according to Andrew, Master Boot Record drives too. And can boot from drives partitioned using any of those schemes. So an Intel Mac can boot from Master Boot Record, according to Andrew. And then according to Brian and everything else I read on the internet, Apple Partition Map as well as GUID. You cannot install Mac OS X onto an Apple Partition Map partitioned drive when running an Intel Mac because the installer application for Tiger and Leopard demands that you reformat the drive using GUID. You can, however, clone a boot drive from GUID to APM and then boot an Intel Mac from that APM partition. So we sit corrected because I am not standing tonight.
But it's just we.
Oh, boy.
Now, you know, I did find something, though, that kind of bothered me.
Okay.
Which led us to give not entirely correct advice.
We're going to call it wrong advice. It's okay to be wrong, you know.
Wrong is so, you know, absolute, wrong. Though.
It's just wrong.
In that sense, it's correct. We can be correct in saying that we were wrong.
Well, I just noticed that Apple Disk Utility, when it talks about partitions, is not entirely correct in the information that they provide. So,
all right. Well, there you go. Yeah, what did it say? Read what it says.
Apple
there.
Partition Map. To use the disk to start up a PowerPC-based Mac or to use the disk as a non-startup disk with any Mac is what they say.
Yeah.
So that's...
Yeah, they do. They force you to use GUID with the Intel-based Macs, but you do not have to, although I think there's probably good reason to do so, and I don't have that at my disposal at the moment.
Yeah.
So... We will move on. We will thank Andrew and Brian, and we will move on to Mickey.
We will?
Yeah, because he has a fine question.
Yeah, yes.
Hey, John and Dave. This is Mickey out in Phoenix, Arizona, and I'm looking for some battery advice. I, like I'm sure many other people, use my MacBook Pro as a desktop replacement and have an external monitor and multiple external hard drives plugged into it, as well as many, of course, portable devices as well, and rarely take it off the desk. So my question is, what is the best advice you can give for maintaining the battery the best way possible. What I'm finding is I've had my MacBook Pro for 2 years. I've already gone through one battery with relatively low cycle count. It was around 50, and it was absolutely shot. And I think it has a lot to do with never unplugging it. So I guess I could unplug it every once in a while, but what is really the best advice that you could give on how often to power cycle the battery? Thanks. Love the show.
All right. I do the same thing you do, Mickey. I only take my MacBook Pro off my desk when I travel or I need to test wireless networks or something. For the most part, I'm in the same boat you are. And like you, I have gone through many replacement batteries, probably a handful of them over the years. The good thing is Apple will replace batteries that die that have very low cycle counts. They say, oh, wait a minute. You know, if your cycle count's less than 30 and the battery's not holding the charge, okay, you got a problem. Really what they should tell you is, dude, you know, you got to use your battery sometime because that, in fact, is the thing that keeps it going. I don't know. I know, John, you probably use your battery more than me. I endeavor and usually succeed to cycle my battery. And by cycle, I mean, let it go all the way down and then plug it back in and charge it up once a month. I probably should try to do it more often than that. So I actually get to do it once a month, but that seems to be enough and seems to keep the battery happy, much longer than previous. What do you do, John?
I usually, at this point, I actually have two batteries, and I'll go between them. So, yeah, I'll run them down. Same thing about, you know, once a month, I'll run them all the way down.
Okay.
Or it hibernates or, dies. And then I have two batteries, and I'll kind of bop between them. So they're always at about the same state. But no matter where I am, I have three power adapters. I have one upstairs, two upstairs and one downstairs.
Okay.
In the main areas that I use the machine. So I'm almost always plugged in and charging the battery and topping it off or having it in trickle.
Yep. Yep.
But sometimes I'll go to a location where I don't want to lug the adapter along.
And you find cycling them once a month tends to keep them working for a reasonable amount of time.
Yeah. And I've never seen them get into the weirdness, you know, of 99% full and stuff. When you start getting... Yeah. To that point, then usually either the battery's starting to die or the calibration is off.
Yep. And to calibrate the battery, you do just what you said, right, John? You let it totally die. Don't plug it in when it starts warning you. Just let it shut the machine off. Bring it all the way back up to a charge after that and do it again is, I think, the accepted method for calibrating a battery. Is that, would you agree, John?
Yes. And I use something called X Battery, which will show you interesting things like the amperage, whether it's in charge or trickle charge mode.
Yep.
The maximum current. I'm sorry. Yeah, the maximum capacity.
Yep.
What is that in? Yeah, amp hours.
Milliamp hours.
Things like that. Milliamp hours. Yes.
Yep. Yep. Cool. We have time for one more. I'm not even going to check the time. We have time for one more question.
Go.
It's because Pete's sitting with me here. He's, you know.
Hey guys, this is Mark from Los Angeles. I have a quick question in need of possibly your help. I recently updated my MacBook. I went from the old black MacBook to a new 13-inch MacBook aluminum. And I have been doing a backup using the time capsule through Time Machine. And I was looking to basically replace everything on my new computer through Migration Assistant using my Time Machine. And it's going to take about 12 hours to do that, and I'm a little impatient. And I was wondering if there was a way of going into my time capsule that has all my Time Machine backups and sort of just going into there and picking some things out. I had some important information within DevonThink stored away in there, and I was hoping I can get into my time capsule to dig it out. So I was wondering if you guys know of any way of doing that, not having to use Migration Assistant, or if there is a program out there that will allow me to do that. So any help would be great. Love the show, guys. And if you need to send me an email.
All right, cool. We'll just answer it here. So I think, John, what do you, go ahead. You got this one, or at least you can start this one.
Yeah, we were talking beforehand. I get nervous trying to circumvent built-in mechanisms like Migration Assistant and stuff like that. Which is what I'll say. If you want to grab the data, you know, should be able should do it through the time capsule interface. So that's my take on one aspect of this.
Yeah, I agree.
Don't touch it.
The problem
is you can. Now, you know, I've noticed this, and I'd say this is probably a good thing. Well, OS X hides a lot of things from you, like a lot of the low-level Unix directories. There's no reason you need to see that stuff, at least from the UI. You can if you want.
Yeah.
You know, but I noticed the other day, you know, like I was mentioning, you know, I'm working on this installer, and XP by default, you know, when you try to, you know, jump in the system folder and stuff, it's like, you know, I don't really think you should be here, but if you really want to be, then click here, and then I'll show you what you...
Right.
What you think you're looking for.
Right.
I just tend to trust the built-in stuff. To follow on, though, Dave, I think you have kind of a little trick with
Time
capsule I didn't know about.
Well, the first thing I do is would say, yeah, if you want to go and dig this data out, go into your time capsule. And John, help me with the navigation here. You go into the time capsule, choose the drive, open up the disk image. Inside the disk image, you'll see backups.backupdb. And then inside that, you'll see the drive name or drive names of the drives that are backed up for whatever computer created that disk image. And then inside those folders, or maybe one way, maybe it's backwards from that, but you will see a list of folders with dates. And at the top of that list, or the bottom, will be a folder called current. In that, that's an alias to the most recent backup. And you can dig in there, and then it's just like navigating your hard drive. You can dig in there and find the files, so if you know where to look, you can go pull stuff out. And in theory, it should work just fine. If you want to let Time Machine do it, if you go to your Time Machine menu at the top of your screen in your menu bar, and you click on the little menu, if you're already backing up, you'll see an option. It's the third option down called Enter Time Machine. If you're not backing up, or if you are and hold down the Option key, you'll see a listing called Browse Other Time Machine Disks. And this will let you go and look at other Time Machine backups and pull just the files you want, treating them as an existing backup. It'll bring you into the time capsule or Time Machine interface with the stars flowing, and you can go and choose a date and then go and restore just the files that you want. So that would be the Apple prescribed, officially supported method of doing this, Mark, is get in there and do it that way. So that's what I would do. But if you want to, you can go and navigate to that current folder and pull stuff out. So that's the... That's my advice, and with that, I'm going to try and bring the band in here, John.
It's nice weather to be out.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it was beautiful today.
Except for the buckets of pollen that the trees were dumping on.
Yeah, I think that finally got me. I was out after we did the scavenger hunt. I was out doing some work in the yard, and just not good. But I'm coming down your way tomorrow, so I'm going to see two concerts between now and when we do the podcast next. So tomorrow night I'm going to see Unwigged and Unplugged, which is Spinal Tap Acoustic down at the Beacon Theater in New York, and then that'll be Tuesday night. And then Sunday, I found someone to sell me for face value tickets to see Phish at Fenway Park. So thank you so much. Yeah, Dark Ambient on Twitter was the savior, my savior on this one. I was going to go pay StubHub exorbitant fees, and he saw that and replied to me, and he's like, no, dude.
What's StubHub? Is that like legal scalping? Or
It's a ticket exchange is what it is. It lets people set prices for the tickets. StubHub charges you 10% on top of whatever they pick as their price, but they guarantee that the tickets are going to be good or your money back. So, and they facilitate the whole process without sharing your information around. And yeah, keep saying eBay bought them. I think you're right. Yeah, I think you're right.
It's good cash.
Yeah, it is a good business model. It kills me to pay that kind of money for Phish tickets when back in the day, you know, I used to show up at a show with extra tickets and just give them away to people. So it was nice to see a little bit of that karma come back. Yeah, why not? if I had an extra ticket.
Aren't you a heck of a guy?
Fish tickets were always relatively cheap. I mean, I would pay like $20 or $30 for a ticket, so we'd buy a couple extras, and if we couldn't get friends to come with us, we'd just... The intention would always be, oh, we'll sell them in the lot. But, you know, you see somebody nice and just like, here, thanks, take it, you know. Yeah, so.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you got any extra tickets for these things?
Not for these, no. No, I wish I did.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Yeah, well, you know. So, all right, where are we here? Pete's distracting me.
Wasn't me.
Yeah, I'm sure it wasn't. Where are we here? iPhone Alley is the home of Michael Johnston, who has converted this show to AAC for all of your listening and interactive pleasure. John F. Braun on the other end there. He's the one doing the show notes and rocking that out. Cashfly.com provides all the bandwidth for us. The podcast marketplace is where all our sponsors hang out there. That is the A5, A2 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, BB Edit from Barebones Software, Text Expander from Smile on My Mac, Notebook from Circus Ponies, and one free download from Audible at audiblepodcast.com/MacGeekGab, all through the Backbeat Media Podcast Network. They can contact us, John. All you listeners out there can contact us. You heard all these people write in and call in. How do they call in, John?
Well, if you want to call in using the old-fashioned telephone, you probably call 206-666-GEEK, which is
4335. And you can email us at feedback@MacGeekGab.com. John, that is...
Did you say feedback@MacGeekGab.com?
I said feedback@MacGeekGab.com. That's exactly right. You can see the show notes that John creates at MacGeekGab.com or MacObserver.com/podcast or wherever that brings you.
I tweet them.
And John tweets it out. That's right. So John is JohnFBraun@Twitter.com. I'm Dave Hamilton. Pete is Pilot Pete, and you can follow the Mac Geek Gab link, which will give you just the show stuff and perhaps a little idle chatter from here and there. It's a good place to tweet questions because both John and I see them, and if one of us can, we'll get out there.
If we're distracted enough, we'll get the question.
That's right.
Yeah, we got to do another think about considering.
Yeah, think about considering. Look at us.
Trying to, build expectations here.
That's right. Let's get out of here. My throat's falling away.
Made up.